We have seen the Lord glorified by God. So today is Ascension Sunday, the week before Pentecost, the week when we're brought the story of Jesus some weeks after his resurrection, returning to heaven. The last time that the physical post-resurrection body of Jesus would be seen in the flesh, as it were. The ascension marks the last act in the miracle that begins at Christmas in the incarnation, in which Jesus comes from heaven into creation, and then on Good Friday descends from creation into death, returns on Easter Sunday to creation, and then completes the cycle by returning to heaven at the ascension. And given our series, we have seen the Lord and the theme glorified by God, that would be a pretty good take, a pretty good way of thinking about these readings. But I always feel with the ascension that it leaves us wondering, what are we going to do about that? What do we do with that knowledge? It's a lovely symmetry, Jesus coming down and then returning back up. But where does it leave us today, those who weren't actually witnesses to these events, who didn't see Jesus taken into glory? So I'm actually going to reflect a bit more on the gospel reading set for today, in which Jesus, before this all happened, prayed. And prayed about glory. After Jesus had spoken these words, he looked into heaven and he said, "Father, the hour has come. Glorify your Son, so that the Son may glorify you." Glory. That's one of those words, isn't it? I wonder what it brings to your mind. I think we all have a kind of sense of, as it were, the vibe of the thing, but it's a very hard word to pin down, especially actually in the English language, and especially when it comes to speaking of the glory of God. The Hebrew people of Jesus' day, those who first heard those words that Jesus spoke, had perhaps a much clearer idea of the glory of God than we do. The Hebrew word for glory is a kabod. I'm sure it's not pronounced like that, but that's how it gets transcribed. Kabod. It's used of God hundreds of times in the Old Testament scriptures. It's used to describe what God is, the God of glory, and to name what God does. But most importantly, it gets used to describe the visible or the tangible presence of God. It's used to describe those times, those places, those visions where God is most seen, most real. It gets used like that in key moments throughout the Old Testament. At Mount Sinai, when Moses is about to receive the law, the Ten Commandments from God, we read, "The glory of the Lord settled on Mount Sinai. The cloud covered it for 6 days, and on the seventh day, God called Moses from the cloud, and the appearance of the glory of the Lord was like a devouring fire on the top of the mountain." And then a little bit later on, when the tabernacle, the tent, which was the predecessor of the temple, when the people of Israel were still traveling in the wilderness, when it was completed and dedicated as a place of worship, God declared God's presence by a visible sign of glory. The cloud covered the tent of meeting. The glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. And elsewhere, where the people have turned away from God, we read the word Ichabod. No glory or woe to the glory departed, when God somehow is no longer there. For we know, as the Hebrew people knew, that God is present in all times, in all places, but it's the experience of a people of faith throughout the ages. Indeed, the experience of those of uncertain or no faith as well, that sometimes this presence of the divine seems more real, more intimate, more immediate. In the Celtic Christian tradition, they speak of places as being thin. Thin places, as if to say that here the wall between heaven and earth has been rubbed thin by generations of faith. The presence of the divine, the other side, if you like, feels closer. The glory of God more real. I find that a very helpful image when I think about glory in this passage. And when I think about glory in the life of Jesus. Because if the glory of God is the reality, the presence of God made visible, then where could that be more true than in Jesus? If the glory of God is those thin places where heaven and earth draw close together, where is that truer than in Jesus, where they were united? And with that image of glory, we hear Jesus' prayer, praying for his followers before he is taken away from them. And you might have noticed the word glory came up quite a few times in that passage. I'm going to reflect on a few of them in verses 1 and 4 and 10 from the gospel reading. In verse 1, Jesus prays, "Glorify me so that I might glorify you." Now, on the surface, those words have a certain uncomfortable arrogance almost about them. Glorify me. The way we use the word glory today, that's quite an ask. I want you to bring me glory. I want you to make me look good. But hear them through the lens of the Old Testament understanding of kabod. They take a different flavor. Glorify me so that I might glorify you. If glory is the visible reality of God, then Jesus' prayer is more, make your nature, your character, make your presence visible in me, Lord God, so that I might make your presence visible to the world. Glorify me so that you might be glorified. That sets this prayer into its context. This isn't Jesus praying for glory in the sense that we use it, of being praised, of being thought well of, being proved right. This is about the glory of God, God's presence being made tangible, being made visible. Jesus is glorified. Jesus is the visible manifestation, the concrete image of the reality of God. Like the fire and the cloud in those readings from the Hebrew scriptures made God's presence known. As the thin places of the Celtic traditions of the mystics make God's presence known, Jesus, most of all, makes God's presence known. And that was true throughout his life, of course, but here he speaks as if it is about to become more true. The hour has come to glorify your Son. And the context, of course, was that this prayer was prayed in the farewell discourse, the last conversation Jesus had with his friends after the Last Supper, before he would be taken from them to be crucified. The hour has come for the Son to be glorified. Jesus is about to be betrayed to death. The hour has come for the Son to be glorified, to make known the character and the reality and the presence of God. As Jesus willingly goes to his death, as he accepts the consequences of human greed and selfishness and fear and violence in order to offer us a way back into reconciliation with God and with each other, as he goes to the cross and beyond to the resurrection, the ultimate proof of the triumph of love over hate. As he does this, he is making the character of God known in a way that nothing else ever did or ever will. The God who chooses to suffer alongside God's people. The God who never gave up. However many times those people turned away, however many times we turn away. The glory of God, the character of God, seen in the sacrificial love of Jesus. And then Jesus goes on in verse 4. I have glorified you on earth by finishing the work you gave me to do. The cross, which lies ahead, is the most complete, the most dramatic revelation of God's love, but it's just the conclusion of a whole life lived demonstrating that same love. In the immortal words of Sting, this final act was meant to prove a lifetime's argument. God, Jesus prays, has already been glorified, has already been made known, made close, made tangible by the things that Jesus has done, by the work he has completed, by his healing, his teaching, his befriending, his reaching out to include, his correcting, his loving. Let your light so shine before others, he prayed, so that they might see your good works and give glory to your Father in heaven. In the shining of light, in what people saw in the works of Jesus, they saw the reality of God, the glory of God. But it wasn't just in what he did. And that's where this comes home for us. Because he gave that command, let your light so shine, to those who followed him. And at the conclusion of our gospel reading today, he declared the truth. I, he said, have been glorified in them, in his followers. Jesus says that he has been glorified in his friends, in his disciples, by extension, in us. He has been made known, has been made close, has been made visible through those who have followed him, so that others might say, we have seen the Lord, the glory of God in us. Which is a saying, an idea, which I've got to say is both very hard to hear and very encouraging at the same time. Hard because it implies people will look at us and will draw conclusions about the nature of God. I mean, thanks, Jesus. No pressure in that or anything. People will look at the people of God and will draw conclusions about what God is like. They do. People look at those who identify with Jesus and they come to conclusions about what God is like, for better or for worse. But it's encouraging too, because over the generations, though there have been some pretty terrible failures of making the character of God known, the love of God has also been made known again and again and again in the faithful disciples of Jesus Christ, giving themselves in service and in sacrifice to the world, to their neighbors, to the sick, to those in need, to their enemies. Those who have striven, even at great personal cost, to care. Sometimes in ways which are highly visible, more often in ways which are not, which are simply one-to-one, simply in the love of God shown to neighbor, friend, and enemy. And it's encouraging too, because Jesus says that he is glorified in his people and that he will be. And so surely, somehow, he will make that so. Is making that so. Somehow, Jesus working through his people, through us, will make God's presence known in the world, will enable us, strange though this idea may seem, to be the glory of God. Jesus has been glorified, he prays. In him, the reality of God has been made known. In him, the character of God has been revealed to the world. In him, the presence of God has been made tangible. In the works of his life, in the selfless love of his death, in the power of his resurrection, and now in the ongoing work of his people. People who aren't reflecting back on the Sermon on the Mount once more, aren't just striving to be good people, but to be a people who make the character of God, the loving, welcoming, including character of God, known in the world. So we are the thin places of the world. We, together as God's people, living lives that make what God is like known, tangible, real. Hard and encouraging, I think, in roughly equal measure. Amen.